Several weeks after the disastrous opening of Red Tails, Lucas picked up the phone and called Kathleen Kennedy, the old friend who'd produced all four Indiana Jones films among a 30-year run of blockbusters. Apart from the Indiana Jones movies and the other films she'd produced for Spielberg, E.T., Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, War of the Worlds, there were also the features she and her husband, Frank Marshall, had produced with Spielberg as part of their Amblin Entertainment production company, including Gremlins, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and Back to the Future. Kennedy had great instincts for film and an even keener business sense, but Lucas counted her among his inner circle of friends as well. He knew she was in New York putting the final touches on Lincoln for Spielberg, he told her, and he wanted to meet her in the city for lunch. Kennedy assumed that Lucas merely wanted to catch up, but over lunch, Lucas wanted to talk business, namely his. "I suppose you've heard that I'm moving forward fairly aggressively to retire," he told her matter-of-factly. Kennedy was stunned. "Actually, no," she said. "I was surprised by that," Kennedy said later, "and part of me didn't really quite believe him." She listened patiently as Lucas explained that while he intended to maintain the title of chief executive and serve as co-chairman for at least one more year, he wanted someone to co-chair the company with him, with the ultimate goal of making that person the head of Lucasfilm. Kennedy started rolling through her Rolodex in her head, ticking off for Lucas the names of potential candidates to take over the company. "No, no, no," Lucas said sharply. "I'm thinking about you doing this." Kennedy never even blinked. "You know, George, I actually might really be interested in that." On June 1st, Kennedy formally stepped in as the co-chair of Lucasfilm. It had been an easy decision to make. "I wanted to do this for him as well as myself," Kennedy said later, "because I knew how important it was to him." Lucas would admit as much, announcing, "I've spent my life building Lucasfilm, and as I shift my focus into other directions, I wanted to make sure it was in the hands of someone equipped to carry my vision into the future." One of their first mutual objectives, he told Kennedy, would be to build this company up so it functions without me. "And to do that," he continued, "we need to do something to make it attractive." There was no more obvious way to make Lucasfilm attractive and keep it functioning beyond Lucas's involvement than to take advantage of the company's most visible and valuable commodity, Star Wars. While Lucas had insisted the story he had set out to tell was finished with Return of the Jedi, he admitted now he might have a few ideas for episodes 7, 8, and 9 in a drawer in his office. "So I said to Kennedy, well, let's just do these movies." Lucas and Kennedy brought in Michael Arndt, the Oscar-winning writer of Little Miss Sunshine, to take a crack at writing episode 7 based on Lucas's story ideas. Really just a brief synopsis, as Kennedy remembered, but enough to start. To provide Arndt with support and guidance on the Star Wars universe, they also brought in Lawrence Kasdan, who understood Lucas's rhythms and sensibilities perhaps better than any other screenwriter, to consult with Arndt as needed. In August, Lucas made a trip to Orlando on the pretext of making a surprise appearance at a panel at Star Wars Celebration 6, but with another, even more secret agenda in mind. Lucas took the stage at his panel to ear-splitting applause, without giving the slightest indication that the gears of Star Wars were slowly turning again. Then, while in Orlando, Lucas took to lunch two other celebration attendees, Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher, to try to persuade them to reprise their roles in future Star Wars movies. Hamill was shocked. "The idea that he would say, 'We want to do 7, 8, 9 was the farthest thing from my mind," said Hamill. But he and Fisher both agreed to reprise their roles. And, after considerable discussion, so did Harrison Ford, largely on promises of a meaningful story arc that would close the book on Han Solo once and for all. Kennedy was still settling into her new position when Lucas surprised her as well, by casually bringing up the idea of selling the company to Disney. "He started to lay out what he was thinking," said Kennedy, "but he was intentionally vague. It was a kind of, down the road, this is something I've been thinking of." Only it wasn't down the road. A little more than a year since their breakfast conversation at the Brown Derby restaurant, Lucas was back in discussion with Iger about what a sale to Disney might look like. Lucas pointed out that he and Star Wars would always be indelibly linked, regardless of whether or not he still owned the company. His obituary, he told Iger irreverently, would inevitably begin with Star Wars creator George Lucas. Lucas then was determined to have it both ways, proposing to hand the entire company over to Iger and Disney while still maintaining complete control over Star Wars. He and his team had been taking care of the franchise for a long time, Lucas argued, and therefore knew better than anyone else how to market, license, and produce Star Wars films. I think it would be wise to keep some of this structure intact, he told Iger firmly. We need a few people to oversee the property, you know, who are just dedicated to doing that, so we're sure we get this right. But Iger wasn't biting. Iger was happy to offer Lucasfilm the same kind of limited autonomy he had given to Marvel and Pixar, in which the company would remain essentially intact. But he wanted Lucas to understand in no uncertain terms that if Disney owned the company, it would be Disney and not Lucasfilm that would have final say over all things Star Wars. For the deal to succeed, it was Lucas, not Disney, who would have to pay the highest price. He was going to have to relinquish control. For Lucas, the rebel who had bucked the Hollywood system and fought for the right to control his own destiny, it was an almost unbearable price to pay. After further discussion with Iger, Lucas eventually agreed to sell the company, but not before securing a small compromise. As part of the deal, Disney had to agree to take his story treatments and use them as the basis for any future films. It wasn't the full control he wanted, but at least it gave him some residual influence over the franchise he had created. But even that concession at times seemed more than Lucas could stomach. Every time Iger asked Lucas for his story treatments, Lucas snappishly refused to hand them over until the deal was done. Ultimately, you have to say, look, I know what I'm doing. Buying my stories is part of what the deal is, said Lucas. I mean, I could have said, fine, well, I'll just sell the company to somebody else. Iger was just going to have to trust him. As talks continued, Kennedy could see the conflict openly in Lucas's face. Before she headed out the door each Friday to fly back home to Los Angeles, Kennedy would stick her head into Lucas's office to see how he was doing. Some days, he seemed content and ready to move on. Other days, he seemed uncertain. I'm sure he paused periodically to question whether he was really ready to walk away, said Kennedy. Still, Lucas thought the partnership with Disney made sense and, in a way, brought his own life full circle. He had, after all, been at Disneyland on its opening day in 1955, and in the 1980s had proudly brought Star Wars into the Disney parks with the opening of the Star Tours attraction. At that time, he had praised Disney for its commitment to quality, saying, "When I did something, I've always wanted to make sure it was done right and it was maintained right, operated correctly. And this is the only place in the world like that." Only Disney truly appreciated, as Lucas did, the benefits of being in complete control of a universe. By fall, Iger finally provided Lucas with a broad description of the terms of the deal, which included the use of Lucas's story outlines. Lucas, protective to the very end, would hand them over only after Iger signed an agreement limiting the number of people at Disney who could read them. Iger was delighted with what Lucas gave him, or so he said publicly. From a storytelling perspective, they had a lot of potential, Iger said enigmatically. It wouldn't be the last time Lucas would squabble with Disney over his Star Wars story treatments. On October 30, 2012, with cameras rolling to capture the occasion, George Lucas and Walt Disney Company President Bob Iger signed the agreement selling Lucasfilm to Disney for a staggering $4.05 billion, half in cash, the other half in nearly 40 million shares of Disney stock. That massive amount of money would go to Lucasfilm's sole stockholder, George Lucas. With the stroke of a pen, Lucas became one of Disney's biggest shareholders, owning 2% of Disney's current shares. Only the Stephen P. Jobs Trust, which had sold the company Pixar, my company, Lucas still calls it, owns more. Lucas's hand had been steady as he signed the papers, but it had been an emotional moment. He was saying goodbye, said Iger. Lucas promptly flew back to San Francisco to say his farewells to the staff, now Kennedy's staff, at Lucasfilm, then issued a carefully worded statement to the media. It is now time for me to pass Star Wars on to a new generation of filmmakers, Lucas said. I'm confident that with Lucasfilm under the leadership of Kathleen Kennedy and having a new home within the Disney organization, Star Wars will certainly live on and flourish for many generations to come. That was a certainty. At the same time it had announced its acquisition of Lucasfilm, Disney had also promised the world another Star Wars movie by Christmas of 2015. They could thank George Lucas for that. With all the pieces Lucas had put in place, Kennedy immediately put Episode 7 into pre-production, bringing in J.J. Abrams to direct, and assigning script duties entirely to Lawrence Kasdan. And in a way, things almost seemed the same, as Lucas would still sit in on the story sessions with Kasdan and his writing team at Disney, trying to explain the rules of the universe he'd created. For the most part, though, Lucasfilm and Star Wars were moving on without Lucas. With his business affairs in order, Lucasfilm in Kathleen Kennedy's capable hands, and no more movies to make, Lucas was prepared to move on to the next major milestone, this one in his personal life. After dating her for 7 years, Lucas had proposed to Hobson in January 2013. They were ready to spend the rest of their lives together and were making plans to have a family. Already, a surrogate was carrying a child for them, due in August. The wedding was arranged to take place a couple of months before that. On Saturday, June 22nd, Lucas, looking very much like a man without a worry in the world, wed Melody Hobson at Skywalker Ranch, under one of those impossibly blue and warm California skies. Hobson was walked down the aisle by one of her mentors, former Senator Bill Bradley, while Lucas waited, beaming, with his 20-year-old son Jet at his side, serving as his best man. Amanda and Katie stood off to the other side, serving as bridesmaids. Journalist Bill Moyers, a former Baptist minister, officiated the ceremony. It takes only one person to have met the love of your life, Moyers said touchingly. Eyes were dabbed all around. It was a power wedding in every sense of the word. Among the 200 guests in attendance were Harrison Ford, Steven Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Robert De Niro, Samuel L. Jackson, Ron Howard, and Quincy Jones, with music provided by Van Morrison and Janelle Monáe. There were affectionate jokes that Hobson was one of the lower-profile people at her own wedding. A week later, however, at a second reception in Hobson's hometown of Chicago, it was Lucas who could be said to have had one of the lower profiles, as the event, at Chicago's Promontory Point, jutting out into Lake Michigan, bustled with the political elite, a former congressman, a mayor and a former mayor, a university president, even a U.S. Secretary of Commerce. And only Hobson could have arranged for a 22-piece wedding band with rock star Prince as the frontman. Yet despite the heavy hitters in their widening circle of friends, Lucas remained as unaffected as usual. He would wear a tuxedo for Hobson, who regularly brought him to receptions and conferences and other formal social events, but left on his own, he would return to the comfortable jeans, a button-up shirt, and well-worn white tennis shoes. There would be expensive restaurants, certainly, but Lucas still liked picking up drive-thru from Taco Bell or sitting down at Sizzler. George says to me, "We are normal," said Hobson. And we are. We go to movies every weekend. He likes to have the same experience that others do. So we don't watch in a screening room closed off to the world. We go to the local theater in whatever city we are in. And he was about to experience parenting a young one again, too. On August 9th, 2013, almost 7 weeks after their wedding, Lucas and Hobson's surrogate delivered a baby girl they named Everest Hobson Lucas, after the son of a close friend. It was Lucas's first biological child. At age 69, he was a father again. While Lucas had long been one of the world's most successful filmmakers, with the sale of Lucasfilm, he had also become very, very rich. By 2015, Forbes would list him at number 94 on its list of the 400 wealthiest Americans, with an estimated worth of $5 billion. Lucas found it all just a bit embarrassing. "I've never been that much of a money guy," Lucas told Businessweek. "I'm more of a film guy, and most of the money I've made is in defense of trying to keep creative control of my movies." Lucas vowed to donate the bulk of his wealth to charity. In 2010, he had signed the Giving Pledge, an effort by billionaires Warren Buffett and Bill Gates to encourage wealthy Americans to commit to giving the majority of their wealth to the philanthropic causes and charitable organizations of their choice. For Lucas, his cause of choice would always be education. "I am donating the majority of my wealth to improving education," he promised. "It is the key to the survival of the human race." Already, Lucas had made significant donations to the USC School of Cinematic Arts, donating $175 million in 2006 for a complete overhaul of the campus buildings he'd built or improved with an earlier contribution in the 1980s. In 2014, he would endow three chairs in the department, and in 2015, he and Hobson would donate another $10 million to the school to create the George Lucas Foundation Endowed Student Support Fund for Diversity, providing financial support for Black and Hispanic students attending film school. Another $25 million would go to the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools to develop and build a new arts hall, which Lucas required be named for the influential Black photographer and filmmaker Gordon Parks. And in 2014, Lucas would donate $500,000 to the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, to help the museum develop interactive online tools. They could probably have started by digitizing Lucas's own collection. Lucas owned more than 50 Rockwell paintings, hanging them on the walls at Skywalker and lending them to museums. In 2010, in fact, he and Spielberg had lent the Smithsonian American Art Museum nearly 60 of their own Rockwell paintings for what became an enormously popular exhibit. It was his Rockwell paintings in part that had inspired what Lucas hoped would be one of his legacy projects, a museum in which he could show and share all the art, animation cells, comic pages, movie posters, props, memorabilia, including most of his Star Wars collection, and countless other works of art and artifacts he'd collected over the past 5 decades. "I don't have enough walls," he explained, "which is why I want to build a museum." He thought he knew exactly where to put it. On the grounds of the Presidio near Crissy Field stood an abandoned 93,000-square-foot former commissary that had briefly been occupied by a sporting goods store but now stood vacant. The Presidio Trust, the same board that had granted Lucas permission to develop his Letterman Digital Center on site, was now accepting proposals for use of the commissary. Lucas submitted a proposal to spend $700 million to develop 8 acres at Crissy Field, including turning the abandoned commissary into the George Lucas Museum of Narrative Art. Lucas and Hobson had assembled a powerful slate of backers that included U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, California Governor Jerry Brown, and the co-founders of Twitter and YouTube. Its approval seemed inevitable. It wasn't. In February 2014, Lucas was stunned to learn that the Presidio Trust had rejected his proposal outright. Some thought that the Presidio Trust had it in for Lucas, with whispered accusations that he was either too rich or too liberal or too successful to prevail with the politically charged trust, a campaign that continued to escalate until the National Park Service stepped in to explain coolly that the museum does not merit one of the most important sites in the entire Presidio. The trust offered to work with Lucas to find a more suitable site. Lucas agreed, and the conversation dragged on for another 8 weeks or so, just long enough for Hobson to grow tired of the doodling around. If the trust wasn't able to locate the museum in Lucas's hometown, then why not hers? Hobson, a longtime friend of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, offered to make a phone call. "Don't worry," she told her husband. "I'll talk to the mayor. I'm sure he'll love it." Emanuel was definitely interested. After putting together a task force to look for suitable locations, Emmanuel thought he'd found Lucas the ideal site, a 17-acre parking lot on the lakefront between Soldier Field and McCormick Place, and practically within the shadow of the planetarium. Furthermore, if Lucas would stick with his pledge to pay for all costs associated with the museum, Emmanuel offered to rent the site to Lucas for $1 a year. Lucas agreed that the site was ideal and hired the Chinese architect Ma Yansong to begin working on concept drawings for the museum, including paintings showing what it would look like sitting on the lakefront site. Yansong came up with a futuristic design that looked to some like a giant amoeba oozing out onto the lakeshore. Others thought it looked like Jabba the Hutt. Whatever it was, it wasn't helping Lucas make his case with the Chicago community. Politics, too, were starting to creep into the discussion. This was Chicago, after all, with some alleging that the land was Emmanuel's payback to Hobson for donating money to his mayoral campaign, an accusation both parties ignored. Back in San Francisco, Mayor Ed Lee was scouring his waterfront for an alternative site to offer Lucas, hoping to woo him back to his hometown. But Lucas had vowed to stick with Emmanuel and Chicago for the long haul. The Chicago City Council's Zoning Committee okayed the project, and Lucas was ready to move forward when the nonprofit Friends of the Parks, arguing that a museum was an inappropriate use of lakefront property, filed a complaint in federal court formally objecting to the project. The proposal ground to a halt, and Emmanuel went scouting for other more expensive sites, which also bogged down in mudslinging. Lucas, while refusing to back down, threw up his hands in frustration. It was mind-boggling. He couldn't give away a museum. Doing this museum, I've realized that most cities don't want museums. They don't really care about them, Lucas said during an interview with the Washington Post. You know, it's too esoteric for most people, and they don't see them as educational institutions. In May 2016, Hobson, once again tired of the foot-dragging, issued a blistering press release in which she accused Friends of the Parks of hijacking the process in order to preserve a parking lot, and warned that she and Lucas were now seriously pursuing locations outside of Chicago. By late June, Lucas decided he was done fighting. No one benefits from Friends of the Parks' seemingly unending litigation to preserve a parking lot, he echoed wearily. He will take his museum elsewhere, preferably back to San Francisco, where Mayor Lee has offered a prime piece of waterfront property, an island, actually, directly between San Francisco and Oakland. If it's not located there, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti has also enthusiastically offered the museum a home in Southern California. Whether that is just a bit too close to Hollywood for Lucas's tastes remains to be seen. As of July 2016, he has yet to make a decision. In January 2015, Lucas surprised everyone by releasing, through the Disney distribution machine, the computer-animated musical fantasy Strange Magic. The movie, Lucas's take on Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, was for his daughters, he said, and one he'd been trying to make for years. With a classic rock and roll soundtrack behind it, the title was lifted from an ELO song. It was essentially American Graffiti with fairies and bog creatures, and a fairy tale lesson about not judging others by how they look. Released with little fanfare, though with a poster reminding audiences that it was from the mind of George Lucas, Strange Magic opened to mixed reviews and tanked within 2 weeks. Lucas scarcely seemed to care. He was much more interested in being a doting father than in promoting films at this point, wheeling Everest around dutifully in a stroller or taking her to Disneyland. By the time she's 5, she'll have her own career going and being in school and talking about her friends and her homework, Lucas said. The fun, goofy time will fall into place in reality, as opposed to right now, when she doesn't have much else to do but hang out with her father. Meanwhile, anticipation was running high for Episode 7. So far, Iger, Kennedy, and Abrams had shown that they too knew a thing about promoting Star Wars. When the title of the film was announced in November 2014 as Star Wars: The Force Awakens, fans parsed it with the same obsessive care with which they'd analyzed the titles The Phantom Menace or Revenge of the Jedi. Abrams and Kennedy carefully doled out only the smallest, most tantalizing nuggets of information, sparking fan interest into a frenzy as the film's December 2015 release date approached. As usual, it seemed everyone was excited about Star Wars. Lucas wasn't one of them. Publicly, he put up a good front, telling USA Today that he was looking forward to seeing a Star Wars film in a movie theater with an audience, without knowing what was going to happen first. Lucas wouldn't ever quite get the full crowd experience. He would end up seeing the film at a private viewing with Kennedy and others in early December. He didn't immediately make his views on the movie known. It was left to Kennedy to inform reporters afterward that Lucas had seen the movie and he really liked it, a tepid response to be sure. When he was asked to clarify, Lucas's reply was deliberately narrow. "I think the fans are going to love it," he said. "It's very much the kind of movie they've been looking for." But it clearly wasn't the kind of movie George Lucas had been looking for. Much to Lucas's irritation, Disney had disregarded the story treatments he had given them in 2012, the ones that Iger had claimed had a lot of potential, and had gone instead in their own direction, using a script with story elements by Kasdan, Arndt, and Abrams, but none by Lucas. "They decided they didn't want to use those stories. They decided they were going to do their own thing," Lucas complained to journalist Charlie Rose in an interview that ran on Christmas Day 2015. Furthermore, apart from those few early story sessions in 2012, Lucas hadn't been involved in The Force Awakens at all. Kennedy, caught between her old boss and her new masters at Disney, did her best to be understanding. "If there's one thing I've learned about George, it's that he's never, ever held back," she said. "Having him 100% on board is up to him, and he can't do that unless he's running everything." It's telling that Lucas would compare tearing himself away from Star Wars with divorce. His 1983 divorce from Marcia and its aftermath had been one of the most miserable experiences of his life, mentally, physically, and emotionally. Watching The Force Awakens, he said, was an awkward reality. "Like attending the wedding of your grown child after you've been divorced." "I gotta go to the wedding," Lucas said. "My ex will be there, my new wife will be there, but I'm going to have to take a very deep breath and be a good person and sit through it and just enjoy the moment, because it is what it is, and it's a conscious decision that I made." Lucas would always resent that Disney had permitted Abrams to make a movie for the fans. "They wanted to do a retro movie," said Lucas. "I don't like that." To him, that was just as bad as knuckling under to bullying from studio executives who didn't know a thing about film, but still demanded arbitrary cuts to reduce a movie's running time. Regardless of what people thought of the prequels, they could never say Lucas hadn't been faithful to his own vision for Star Wars. "It was no wonder," said Lucas, "that the people at Disney weren't that keen to have me involved. If I get in there, I'm just going to cause trouble, because they're not going to do what I want them to do. And I don't have the control to do that anymore, and all I would do is muck everything up. And so I said, okay, I will go my way, and I'll let them go their way." And so George Lucas had given up control. But that didn't mean he was ever going to be happy about it. At age 72, George Lucas is retired, enjoying life, and especially enjoying being a husband and a father. He still makes his home at the house on Parkway, and despite the rumors, he still owns Skywalker Ranch, all 6,100 acres of it now, as well as Skywalker Sound, which he's happy to make available to Disney or any other studio to use for a fee. He still dresses in the familiar jeans and flannel shirts with white running shoes. The suits come out only for special events. He's a devoted husband, remains a proud father to his three grown children, and is happy spending most of his day trailing along after Everest. While he stays off social media, the venomous online comments and trolling in the wake of the release of The Phantom Menace convinced him to abandon the internet for good, he's hardly a recluse. He travels widely, attends charity events, and has no problem obliging autograph requests. Still, he's looking for things to do. He still hopes to build his museum in San Francisco or Oakland or Los Angeles, or wherever anyone who values such things will have it. If and when the museum is ever built, you can bet Lucas will be intimately involved in its layout, design, color scheme, and lighting. As with his movies, Lucas will never be entirely happy with a building project unless he can put his hands on as much of it as possible. Like any good parent, Lucas finally saw Star Wars leave the house without him. The Force Awakens shattered nearly every box office record on its release in December 2015, steadily climbing its way past $2 billion in worldwide revenues. Episode 8, still unnamed in mid-2016, was scheduled for 2017, with Episode 9 to follow in 2019. In the meantime, Disney also announced a number of spin-offs, including Rogue One, set just before Episode 4, and movies featuring Han Solo and Boba Fett. The Star Wars universe, born of Lucas's sweat and frustration, and scrawled onto his remarkably low-tech notepads in pencil, seemed poised to exist in perpetuity, passed down from generation to generation into the hands of new writers and filmmakers for them to embrace and then make their own. Star Wars remained as timeless as the imagination, a mythology permanently woven into the culture. Lucas's involvement with his other beloved franchise, however, seems secure, at least for now. With Disney willingly in his corner, Steven Spielberg announced he wanted to bring back Indiana Jones for a fifth time, and that he intended to bring along not only Harrison Ford, but also George Lucas, for Dr. Jones's next adventure. "George is going to be an executive producer on it with me," said Spielberg during the promotion of The BFG, and then, in a not-so-subtle dig at Disney, explained that, "I would never make an Indiana Jones film without George Lucas. That'd be insane. Take that, Force Awakens." Lucas still hoped, too, to return to making the kinds of small, personal, arty films he'd been promising to make his entire career. Documentaries, tone poems, avant-garde ramblings. "Whatever I want to do," said Lucas, regardless of whether it has any commercial potential or not. "His personal films are his real gift," said Coppola affectionately. "I still hope that he made so much money out of Star Wars that he will just make some little movies. He promises me that he will," added Steven Spielberg. "We're still waiting, George." Lucas, in his early 70s, was reflective, though good-natured, about his legacy as a filmmaker and as a human being. He hoped to be remembered first and foremost as a great dad. "After that, I'll probably be forgotten completely," he said, only half-joking. "I hope I'll be remembered as one of the pioneers of digital cinema. In the long run, that's probably all it will come down to." Then, with a twinkle, he added, "They might remember me as the maker of some of those esoteric 20th century science fiction movies." More likely, he would be remembered as the fiercely independent creator of some of cinema's most memorable and profitable films, as well as some of pop culture's most iconic characters. Lucas changed the way audiences watched and rewatched movies. He demolished, then reinvented the way movies were made, marketed, and merchandised. He changed the way fans embraced and adored not just movies and character and actors, but directors, producers, and composers, all of whom Lucas made active and visible collaborators on his films. He redefined the way movie studios financed, distributed, and controlled, and then ultimately didn't control, the art of filmmaking. Lucas also unapologetically invested in what he believed in the most, himself. As a result, the film empire he created would empower not just him, but other similar-minded filmmakers to produce movies exactly as they envisioned them, without a studio imposing its own priorities, grousing about budgets, or micromanaging the process. George Lucas, the small-town son of the owner of a stationery store, had said no to the family business, then built a cinematic empire based on his own uncompromising vision of the film industry not as it was, but as he thought it should be. Much of that vision lay in the possibilities presented by new technology. Technologies Lucas developed with his own money, an inherent ability to hire the right people, and a preternatural knack for asking the right questions. I can't help feeling that George Lucas has never been fully appreciated by the industry for his remarkable innovations, said director Peter Jackson. He is the Thomas Edison of the modern film industry. Lucas, mellowed with age, easily dismissed such sentiments. He knew what he'd done, he knew his place, and he seemed comfortable with it. When asked by interviewer Charlie Rose in December 2015 what he thought the first line of his obituary might say, Lucas gave perhaps the best summation of his lengthy career, or at least the kind of response one could expect from someone at once so modest and audacious, in two single syllable words. I tried, he said, laughing.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of George Lucas, A Life. Written by Brian J. Jones. Read by Jay Snyder. Produced by Christine M. Farrell. Recorded at Audio Media Production. Post-production by James Bennett. George Lucas, A Life is also available as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com, a division of Hachette Book Group. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Brian J. Jones. Audio production copyright 2016, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.